I'm pleased at this time to introduce the official historian of Major League Baseball, who was appointed to that post by Commissioner Selig in 2011, succeeding Jerome Holzman. John Thorne is a longtime Sabre member. In 2006, he received the award that Jan just received, the Bob Davids Award. We know him in many ways as a senior creative consultant for the Ken Burns Baseball Series in 1994. We still see him regularly on MLB Network, ESPN, Public Broadcasting, the History Channel. And we also know him in many ways from his many books, the Total Baseball Series, Hidden Game of Baseball. He's an expert on the origins of baseball, and that's the topic of his latest book, Baseball in the Garden of Eden, The Secret History of the Early Game. John was here about a year ago for a one-on-one interview with Garrison Keillor at the historic Fitzgerald Theater. Please welcome our keynote speaker, the official historian of Major League Baseball, John Thorne.
Thank you for enduring and indulging me. Let me get set up because the peepers ain't what they used to be. I like talking off the cuff, but I figured if I did that for you guys and the luncheon was disappointing, then the burden on the culinary side would have been excessive. So I did prepare a little talk just for you. On September 22nd, 1884, the Boston Unions were playing the St. Louis club when shortstop Walter Hackett, who had played in nearly all the club's games, showed up too sick to play. Outfielder Kid Butler shifted to short as an amateur named Clarence Dow was called in from the stands. He played the whole game in the outfield and did well. You can look it up and you will. But never played another big league game, instead becoming a baseball statistician and reporter for the Boston Globe. Right now, I am feeling a bit like Clarence Dow. Why have I been plucked from the audience to play before my peers? I suspect the reason I'm standing up here, rather than seated in my accustomed spot among you, has something to do with my role as official historian of Major League Baseball. Last year, within days of my appointment by the commissioner, I spoke before the New York City Regional Chapter of Sabre. I said then that gratifying as this post might be to me, it was also a bouquet toss to Sabre, without which I could not have come to understand and serve the game. Several of you in the audience have collaborated with me in Total Baseball and other sabermetric efforts, in historical research, and in Sabre publications. Truly, if today I occupy a high standing in baseball, it is in good measure because I stand on your shoulders. Thank you. Sabre has been great for me, for its members, and for the game. But now I think it is poised to be even better. The new Sabre, in its new location, with new leadership, a new digital publishing program, a new initiative of sponsored conferences, has been embraced half-heartedly by many longtime members. They like the old Sabre just fine the way it was, and have opined in effect that if the thing ain't broke, why fix it? Given the troubling demographic trends of our membership, the question confronting the society appears to be whether we may continue to enjoy it as we always have, in my case for 32 years, or whether we ought to do some estate planning to leave something of enduring value to those who follow. I have long described Sabre as baseball's best-kept secret. That was once a compliment, but became a problem. I believe that Sabre's leadership in a moment of crisis has seized an opportunity to promote the society's work before a broad fan base and to raise awareness of the broad benefits to baseball of historical study and statistical analysis. set aside for the moment whether, as a byproduct of, for example, Sabre's newly announced relationship with Major League Baseball Advanced Media, membership might increase, remain stable, or marginally decline. Set aside whether the new readers Sabre gains at MLB.com will be researchers or, more likely, unconcerned with how the sausage was made. Writers ought to want readers, and more of them rather than fewer. Will the new Sabre have to change its focus? Will those who love the old Sabre be cast out of the revamped organization at the hands of some death panel? I would like to suggest that the new opportunities to extend our message and to enhance our value require the very traits that have permitted Sabre to continue into a fifth decade. We are nerds, you and I. We endure the predictable. Bless you. We endure the predictable slings and arrows on the whole cheerfully, not only because we know who we are, but also because we live in the age of Steve Jobs, Bill Gates, and other nerds for whom data, when shared, become life's most rewarding currency. Ernie Harwell once said, Sabre is the Phi Beta Kappa of baseball. That remains true, and the new Sabre cannot succeed by pretending to be less smart than it is. This is especially true in the age of the nerd, in which knowledge is, at long last, cool. For many years, Sabre's officials bristled when its members were painted with a broad brush and called Sabre matricians. They protested that Cyan members were also interested in history and culture and ballparks and Negro Leagues and the international game. True. But I think it's a good thing that now we do not protest quite so much. The success of the Sabre Analytics Conference in March is testament that Bill James did us a great favor by coining the term Sabre Metrics. Change can be painful in the short run, but change is good. My take on the changes in Sabre that have vexed some veteran members is that the new Sabre, as it rolls out, will be remarkably like the old Sabre. Like baseball itself, on any given day, it will be the same but different. Even if we fit into the larger baseball community a bit better, we will continue to be nerds, proudly self-identified misfits. You meet the most interesting people at a Sabre gathering such as this one. Those who believe that it's what you know, not whom you know, that counts. For me, that is almost the definition of nerddom, a subject of deeply personal interest. I have sometimes thought of writing a book about Sabre's most unusual members, but each time I have turned away because objectivity is impossible. How could I write about nerds as them when it so aptly describes me? In my hastily conducted case study, a baseball nerd, a baseball fan, and a baseball fantasy player are all united by their intense interest in something which they know, in the end, when matched against faith or family or philosophy, may not matter much. Here we are in midsummer, the acme of the real and natural world of baseball. Yet for some of the game's most ardent devotees, like those of us here, the seasons pass almost without notice. For them, us, the grass does not turn brown, ever. In the green fields of their minds, there is a perpetual thrill of the grass. Always there are baseball statistics to digest, projections to make, fantasy transactions to contemplate, and history's attic to excavate. Jocks may call such studious fans nerds, intending to deprecate their drive to gather, interpret, and invent new ways of understanding the grand old game that jocks have always thought they understood pretty damn well. Jocks and nerds are both stereotypes, of course, but in the intensity of their dedication to meter games, they are more alike than different. I have walked the nerds walk and talked their talk, not only in my years as a Sabre member and as a writer on baseball history and occasionally statistics. I have always been literally an old boy, a strangely earnest lad, as long as I can remember, even before nerd was a word. It has always been easy to be nerdy, even when my detached, obsessively focused demeanor seemed to be a problem for others. "Why can't you be normal?" my exasperated mother used to wail. Being odd has been the source of substantial solitary pleasure and a lifetime of wonderful friendships with other like minds who signaled their membership in the nerd tribe, not by their devotion to baseball necessarily, but simply by the intensity of their curiosity, regardless of its object. These were people worth knowing. In recent years, nerds have begun to distinguish themselves from drips, dweebs, geeks, and duds, pejoratives applied by the cool kids for a century and more. While the dictionaries continue to treat square and nerd as synonyms, ask around and you'll find that nearly everyone detects a difference. While both terms connote a measure of social ineptitude or at least discomfort, nerd has come to be associated with intellectual aptitude. It is worn as a badge of honor, even by those not reduced to quivering jelly in the presence of the opposite sex. Indeed, times are good for nerds right now, and not only at the helm of Microsoft or Apple. The internet has brought myriad ways for birds of a feather to flock together and to influence mainstream society and culture. Dr. Seuss created the nerd in If I Ran the Zoo. And then just to show them how sail to cut through and bring back an it-cooch, a creep, and a crew, a nerkle, a nerd, and a seersucker, too. That is the first time the word was used. The first citation in print after that came in the February 10th, 1957 issue of the Glasgow, Scotland Sunday Mail. Quote, "Nerd, a square, any explanation needed?" We're in the realm of tautology here, I think. Like the square peg in the round hole, in the age of conformity, the 1957 model nerd came to be simply another term for misfit. 15 years later, nerds began to drift into Silicon Valley and Wall Street, and such newly sprouted nonconformist clubs as Sabre. Sport provided a particularly fertile ground for alternative viewpoints. The very term denotes peculiarity, as in sport of the litter. The stereotype of the nerd is one who is more comfortable with computers or, back in the early days of Sabre, index cards or shoeboxes, than with human beings. The nerd has a keen scent for phoniness and opposes the dominant culture. The nerd regards information as the most valuable of all currencies, as it permits him or her to show off the fatheads who run major software companies, news organizations, and the like. Globally, techno-nerds are united in their hunt for covert data. No bit of information is too trivial for consideration, as long as it was not previously known. This, by the way, describes Sabre at its most mockable level. It is the prestige of ownership that makes a data hound into a geek among geeks. I offer myself as occasionally a case in point. It's pretty childish, really, because the most accomplished nerds and the ones who gain the respect of their kind are those who are most disposed to share and least inclined to preen. And yet, the lure of late-night web trawling is that you will find something very nearly in plain sight that had been overlooked for eons until you, O perspicacious one, spied the gold amidst the dross. A nerd trait we might term stubbornness, or independence, or principle, or tenacity, might as easily be called arrested development. A broad and amorphous label that is marked by three essential qualities. A treacly nostalgia for a false childhood, one more imagined than lived, with unrealized adult benchmarks. Or an affectionate attachment to the media kitsch of one's childhood, such as knowing the theme song to Gilligan's Island. And last and most useful, and improbably preserved, childish sense of curiosity and wonder. A veneer of cynicism may also present in a self-protective way, but it will be easily penetrated. Scratch a cynic, find a sentimentalist. In the further classification of nerds, it may be noted that they don't like to be fussed over, be confined in small places, or have their personal space violated by strangers. They may themselves, however, be fussy, pushy, and insensitive to the social requirements of others. Like Amazon headhunters, they collect things, either mementos of experiences they may have had or wish to have had, or items associated with persons of power, from Winston Churchill to Babe Ruth. With their active imaginations, nerds generally have little need for the company of others, though on the odd occasion when they are feeling companionable, the absence of companions may seem a cruelly personal affront. In my own life as a nerd, I learned to read by deciphering the backs of cereal boxes and baseball cards. Like all lonely boys, I became a list maker and daydreamer, able to slip into a warm, fuzzy fugue state. I built models, I collected fetishes, from baseball cards to bottle caps, from comic books to backdate magazines, and thus fortified myself against the demands of the outside world in my intense devotion to mastery as the amulet against who knew what. Even today, when I might look back on a long career, I remain on the lookout for the next thing. The way a man will look over the shoulder of his date at a dinner table to check the woman who's just walked in the door. Yes, what I'm doing is fun, but... like Lou Waddell, easily dazzled by shiny figures. There's nothing that is as much fun, Yogi Berra ought to have said, as learning something you didn't know before. Far more than social disability, it is the delight of knowing things and gathering chaos that defines nerddom. Despite nerds' public show of odd interests, there is a secret joy that pervades their lives, blurring the distinction between work and play, between adult and child. This may serve either to perpetuate childhood or to make up for a childhood missed. My parents, given to second-guessing my every move when we were in the same space, went off to work daily and thus were occupied elsewhere much of the time, permitting me to spend a significant part of my youth playing ball and pursuing vice, with only middling success in either. This is how and when I was made a nerd. Finding a place of retreat was, as I saw it, a path to happiness, a world of my own making. For many future nerds of America, that world will be off in the future, a science fiction playground. For me, that safe haven was in the past. Old books, old music, old film, old folks long dead, but not to me. This was a private world, a world that was perfect, if perhaps not perfectly sane. It was fitting that, as I progressed in baseball and early on gravitated to statistics, I should be described as a figure filbert, that old-fashioned term for a status nut. Which brings us back to the one-game major leaguer whom I mentioned at the head of this speech, Clarence Dow, who became a baseball writer. Upon Dow's untimely death at age 38, Boston Globe sports editor Jacob Morris wrote, "He was preeminently alone in his line. There was no one to vie with him, no one in his class. Dow was the greatest statistician the game ever knew. He gloated over his statistics, and many of his statements were entirely original with him. His matter in the Boston Globe every Monday during the baseball season was devoured with the greatest avidity by the baseball cranks. He can't be replaced because no one can be found who can or will take time to undertake the tremendous amount of work necessary to produce like results." Clarence Dow, a pioneering nerd, is a neglected patron saint of Sabre. "He can't be replaced," Jacob Morris said of him, but of course he was. By Ernie Lanigan, by F.C. Lane, by Alan Roth, by Pete Palmer, by Bill James, and legions more. Baseball has not lacked for nerds. But until Bob Davis came up with the idea of Sabre back in 1971, there was no place for them to convene and consult with their brethren. There was no way but through long and lonely effort, sadly unpublicized, to advance our understanding of this great game. If the new Sabre is to reach greater heights, as I believe it is bound to do, it will do so upon the foundations built by the old Seaver. If we are to continue to record and preserve the story of baseball and to provide a virtual think tank for its analysis, then the old Seaver must play the vital role simply by continuing to be itself. To conclude, I will invoke the words of the most interesting man in the world. Stay nerdy, my friends.